This is going to be Claire Matthews and Leona Matthews on September the 2nd, 1979, talking about Dogan Farm back in the early days when they were there.
I was there.
Okay, here's Claire, and he's giving the times when he was there. Okay.
Well, now, to be real accurate, now, you see, I was attending the short course at Madison, and then there was a summer vacation, you see, starting along in March. I think that was 1917. I was there as a single man, of course. And then, you see, the war came on. I went back to the school again, and I came back to Dr. Taylor's at Syene. And then from there, I worked for my brother-in-law a year, and then I went back to Taylor's again, and I went to the war, and then I came back there, and I was manager of his farm there. And then it seemed like it's an awful hard for me to get this old rickety mind of mine working, but eventually what happened was that I came back to the Dogan farm. And I was there, well, in all, let's say in all of the 20s there, there's probably involved about 7 or 8 years of work up into the early 30s till about 33. And then you see, I changed this sign set up, you see.
You were at Dogan's, that's what they want.
Yeah, well, I was in there until about 1933. That would be about... Then you see, I finally ended up soon after that at the Cross Milling Plant and was there many years.
That's, and then after you married, you moved to that house on the corner of Milwaukee Road and...
We lived on Griffith's home.
Yeah.
Griffith had it later.
See, Griffith's wife died and he was more or less alone, and then he was sort of a farm manager apparently at your farm, and I came in as a herdsman. That's what happened in there. Well, that's approximation, that's a problem.
Well, then, as I remember, you and my father got concerned about the burr grinders, that you thought that you could make a better feed if you could flatten that grain out. There wouldn't be so much to go through the cows for the pigs.
And what happened right there, I might break in right there, I went over to Afton, where they had a sort of a milling plant for the roller mill. And I went over there and I saw just what that would do. Now, I don't know whether they were making rye flour or doing something with that roller mill, but it gave me an idea that that was an idea that I wanted. Well, then I came back and I was walking downtown one day by the drugstore downtown, and it had a mortar and pestle, whatever they call it, on the front of the drugstore.
Yeah.
And it had this grinding affair, you know, in there. And I said, that gives me an idea. If I had some way, see, this is grinding with pressure rotating in there. If I had some way to make that sort of principle work, and I kept dwelling on that idea. And I don't know why I run onto the idea, though. I run onto the... Now, is this something that means anything in this story?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, you remember the Welch cabbage farm?
Yeah, sure.
They had a tremendous, great, big junk pile of machinery and odd pieces of old wagons and everything else. And in the meantime, I was getting an idea. Why couldn't I take the axle and the skein, or whatever they call
the
two,
skein is the idea,
and the tapering fit there, and groove that in a way. I cut off some of the length of it and so forth.
I don't think you grooved it at first. I think that the first thing that you did was to put them together and then turn the axle in there, but the grain wouldn't go down, and when it got down a little bit, why, it would burn and clog.
Yeah.
And then you ground. Then you put a spiral into the axle.
That could very well be. Well, you see, the other thing is where the Dobin farm comes in. For the hopper, I used one of your strainer funnels that you poured milk into. You don't have a screen in the bottom. I used that as a hopper. And then to have the power to operate this, I used the washing machine motor at the Griffiths.
In our house where we stayed.
Yes.
In the basement.
The basement, the washing machine motor to operate this little three-legged outfit that I've made. Now, Schwebke, the mechanic, did the crude mechanical work of helping me cut that metal, you know, to make the frame and so forth, and get that inserted in there, and this was a vertical operated thing. At the very bottom was the pulley. And then at the bottom of this cone-shaped grinding business was a spout came out there. Well, anyway, I tried to see there'd be a sort of a start on seeing whether that would work or not. It did, but only momentarily because of lack of power. See, what would I have? Horsepower or something like that. Maybe not that much on the washing machine, anyway. There wasn't no power to be effective. Well, then I took the outfit up to your barn. Now, you had a 15-horse motor there, see, and that was more than I needed, but I put on a sort of a narrow, 2 or 3 inch belt or something. We found a piece somewhere and made it to power this thing. Well, then, you see, I started to do business because it was running it too fast and everything. One of the trouble is running it too fast, but it was taking stuff through and flattening it. But finally, after it run a little bit, to my surprise, I put some corn meal that you had there, I think something in there, and it puffed. And I said, lo and behold, what goes on here? And then the thing got on fire. What's this? And then it got on fire, see, and I said, well, I'm on the wrong track here.
Hello, Homer.
And you asked me if I'd like to come to work for you. And that must have been 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
I would think.
Well, you must have been, about 10 years old or something like that?
Oh, not
when you were riding the pony, you must
have. Oh, I was 10, yeah.
This is Homer that's here. Okay, and Homer says he saw Dad get a six-pack.
You must have been about 10 years old by that time.
Yeah, I was 10 or 12. I guess.
Something like that, yeah.
I think it was 12 years old was the last time I was there. I mean, that I can remember that we were there, right, at 12?
Well, when I talked to Warren, I said that I figure you must be about 56.
59.
And he said, that's right. 50. Well, then you'd be 59 because you were the oldest.
Yeah.
Okay, and Warren said, well, you hit it right on the button.
Yeah.
Because I said, I'm 51 and you were a big boy. I said, all you guys were... You
yeah.
brothers were big boys when I was there.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So have you folks.
So you remember the pony?
Oh, definitely.
Now, this was the little pony.
Yeah. The name of it. What
well, the guys name? Called her Mona. We called her Star, but the guys called her Mona.
Yeah, I don't recall what name we did call it. But we used that to pick the corn tassel with. I was your corn tassel picker.
Well, now wait, maybe by the time we were picking corn, we didn't have the pony. We had the horse that we called Jeff. That was a horse at that point.
Well, I used to use, what was his name? The grain dealer, what was his name that lived down by
Roy Beeman?
Roy Beeman. I used to use his pony.
Yeah.
For picking tassels. He was a little taller.
That's right.
Now that I think about it.
Because that pony vanished after a while. I don't ever know what happened to that pony.
But I picked tassels on Veman's pony for, I don't know how many seasons, but I used to pick tassels.
Well, we didn't start pulling tassels, did we, till about 38?
About 38.
Because I started in on the crew myself at about 40, and it had been going on a year or two. I was tall enough by 40 to get in on it.
Yeah, three rows without and two rows with, all staked out. And my pants would wear thin like tissue paper. That was quite a day you spent in the cornfield. But I don't remember the small horse. I remember Kit, the white horse.
Kit, yeah.
And Prince.
Kit and Prince.
Barney, the bow-legged, what was...
Then there was a roan horse got in there.
Well, that was the offspring of Beauty. Wasn't it Beauty they call that black horse that your dad bought? That high-spirited horse, mare?
Can't remember.
We used to, she used to get so excited, we had to put pour water on her head and get her calmed down. She was the, that's where the roan was the offspring of her.
Pour water on her head?
Yeah, she gets overheated from excitement. And she was a high-spirited horse. It was about the most high-spirited horse we had there. And
didn't we have a horse named Pete? Pete and Barney?
Pete and Barney, yeah.
Bess? Did you have a Bess?
Wait a minute, was that a Pete and Barney?
One of those horses that you took downtown being led behind a truck, and it got the carbon dioxide gas, and it died from that fume from the truck. I remember that.
Good Lord. That was in the 20s, huh?
That was some time in those years there. I don't know just when, but I know that's what happened. The horse apparently didn't die right away, but it affected the horse so that the next day or something, that the horse died from the carbon dioxide gas that it breathed, you see, back there by the exhaust.
You were too young, Ron.
But Barney, you remember, went blind from moonstruck. They call that sort of moon disease. You know,
Moon eye.
It went blind.
Turned kind
Barney
of
did.
Yeah.
And you had your fancy Roman-headed horse, riding horse there for a while.
Oh, that belonged to George Garrigan, and it was a jumper.
Yeah, a jumper.
Right.
It was had the stiffest legs you ever saw in your life. I mean, when you trot that horse, it just
was that Jeff? Pieces. Was that the one we called Jeff?
I don't remember.
It used to be a racehorse?
It was a racehorse.
Well, that was Jeff. That was the one we called Jeff. Us kids, we made a long list of names for it. And I used to ride that horse a lot when I was 9, 10, 11 years old.
Claire, were you around when we rented some pasture west of town and drove heifers across town, across the Portland Avenue Bridge, and 4 or 5 miles west of town for the summer?
I don't think so. I remember that you had young stock that I used to go out to inspect and take pictures of at the hill farm.
Yeah, well, you missed that particular year or two. But when we came to the Portland Avenue Bridge with this 20 head of young stock, they wouldn't go onto the bridge. Mm. And one of them ran down the bank beside the bridge and jumped into the river. And the whole gang of them followed him right into the river. They swam across the river and climbed up on the other side.
That was... I must have missed that, though.
Let me just be sure we're getting... Okay, we're getting it fine.
I don't know what you're striving for material, but boy, there's a million memories of that.
Well, let's start hearing them. We'll get everybody's.
I don't know.
Do you want a piece of paper? And when you think of them, jot it down. So well,
everything comes at random.
Well, take them. I'll take them at random.
Well, just like the blacksmith's shop at Nussbaum.
Nussbaum. Yeah.
Okay, tell me about that.
We used to bring the horses in there for shoeing, and that used to be a really exciting place because all the thrashing and of horses thrashing around, you know. And I really enjoyed going down there. I don't know who I went with. I think Mr. Griffith, you know, used to take the horses down there for shoeing.
The smell of
and the smell of the burning horseshoes and the thrashing of the horses, the twitch on the nose to keep them calm. And it was always a big experience for a kid, you know, to be down into a blacksmith shop. I thought it was really terrific. Lots of excitement.
Mm-hmm. Remember any specific incident in connection with the blacksmith shop?
Uh-huh. Well, we both remember them heating the shoes up in the forge and pumping air into the coal. They had a bellows that worked for their foot. And as I remember, and then when they get the shoe hot enough, he'd take it on his anvil and shape it. take up a horse still hot, fit it on his foot. If it didn't fit exactly, why he'd either he'd shoe up again and shape it again until he got it just the way he wanted it to. And then he would douse it in a barrel of cold water, cool it off, and pass it on the horse's foot.
Mm-hmm. Just as a trivia with that heating, I think it was to set the nail part of the hoof too, to burn it in so it would be flush, you know, so everything would set right. But, you know, in making horseshoes in those days, they shaped it with just bars of steel and shaped it around and made the tip part on the front, you know, and everything. You pound that all out, where today it's all stamped out as standards. Numbers, you know, and then they fit it to the horse's
foot. Just like in a shoe store now, huh?
Yeah, but they change them for the particular foot a little bit. But then in those days, it was just taking a piece of metal and strap.
Mm-hmm. So you used to go down there too, Dad, from a kid on, huh? From when you were a little bitty kid right up. Where was Nussbaum's located?
Right on along the river, right?
Yeah, on Pleasant Street. That was where he finished up by, anyway. Then there was another blacksmith shop. Shaw's horseshoeing.
And would you go there sometimes,
yeah,
too?
And then there was another one in town. Well, it's quite a job keeping the horses in shape. By the way, Homer, I've got a grandson. I've got dozens of grandsons, but as this particular boy, when he was born, I took one look at him and said, you're Barney. And when he got old enough to know why I called him Barney, he said, you remind me of a favorite horse I had one time.
Yeah.
He still likes to be called Barney. He's grown and married now. I have two grandchildren.
Great-grandchildren.
Great-grandchildren.
Well, look, let's go back to Claire for the moment, and you think up some more. And Claire, you had just gotten that machine
up
into the barn, and it caught fire. All right.
Caught fire. Well,
the machine caught fire, or the motor caught fire?
The machine caught fire. It started to flame because of the grain in the hopper and all that. The machine is running so fast that the frictional element of it there was metal was rubbing, and it made the thing practically red hot.
Uh-huh.
And that's what started the smoke. At least it smoked, see. And I said, well, I can't. I've gotten the wrong idea here. But while this was burning, I had some sort of a pattern maker who was going to do some pattern making to make a little better model that I had. We'd make kind of a professional job of it. And he stepped in the door and saw the smoke. He said, I don't want any part of making any patterns for you, because you're going to murder yourself and burn this barn down. So I got nothing out of him for patterns. Now, I can't remember. It don't seem like it was that. Who was the fellow that was a carpenter around there and so forth?
Keller?
Mark Keller.
Keller. Now, it seemed like it was him. He wasn't going to do any professional pattern job, but he just wanted to see, just to see and talk with me about it and so forth. But anyway, that ended any pattern business going on for him. So I don't know what I did to get a hold of somebody to work. Wasn't there a place down in there by the Mork Foundry? Is that what it was called? It was a pattern maker in there?
Well, the man named...
There were some pattern makers.
Krause.
Hmm?
Krause? Didn't it?
No, that was Krause. No, that was Milling, wasn't it? No, he was a pattern maker. There was right down in there by that Mork Foundry. Now, I don't know.
Yeah.
He kind of worked in connection with the foundry, you know, making patterns and so forth.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I went in with him, and we worked out making some patterns. Well, then when he got the patterns made, we went over to Nielsen's. Nielsen is an engineer down there in South Beloit, you know where that was.
Yeah.
And he drew up blueprints, or whatever you call it, so that it could go back into the foundry to be made. Well, then there was, in the meantime, well, that probably has to stop there, because in the meantime, Swepke, myself, Swepke, and Swepke went uptown, and Swebke always had a straw hat with a crown out of it. And his little hairy head was dangling up there in the air. And he had a bad leg that he kept his pants leg up above his knee and had a great big patch on his leg. Something had bruised his leg so that he had to keep it kind of in the open air or whatever it was. And we went stomping up there to Harry Adams' office. Went up to Harry Adams' office to get a promotion for this because it looked like we had something that we just wouldn't have the finance to handle and so forth. So we went up there and we talked with Harry. And then in turn, Harry Adams contacted this man at the ironworks.
Barry.
Barry contacted him. And it wasn't too long, we sat in a huddle. Well, in the meantime, you see, this was kind of coming along from the Nielsen outfit, yeah. And Barry, with his engineering education and skill and all that, he got in touch with Nielsen, because Nielsen hadn't hardly started yet, and gave him some idea in which they made a vertical. He changed it to a vertical layout instead of, not vertical, horizontal, I mean, yeah, horizontal. You had your hopper, and you had your screw, and you had your head, you know, that had a stator in it with the grooves and the screw that worked in there. And then you had your clearance, your narrow clearance that the grain was squeezed through to make the flake. And then, you see, we had this taken up out to your Dogan farm there and had the motor then, and we had something substantial enough then, you see, that could stand all this power, and it had adjustments so we could change this clearance. Otherwise, my clearances weren't adjustable, you see, and you could change this clearance. So we got that going, and oh boy, that grind feed like the dickens. Well, then the next thing, you see, your dad had a Fairbanks burr grinder. And that's the one I was complaining about. It was doing a haphazard grinding, so that the granulation of corn and everything, you see, you were just going through the cow's digestive system and wasn't assimilating enough out of the grain. So then, you see, we set up this little mill there and bolted it down and got it lined up with the motor there. And we put the mixtures of feed, of corn, and it had to all be shells, you see, because it didn't have any, like the burr mill, it didn't have anything to break down the cob. And it was through stuff to beat the band there. So we set it up. If we set it up too close, it would clog. So it would do a good mashing job, though, with the pressure we put through there. And it would do about 50 pounds an hour, where the burr mill would do about 125. There's quite a lot of difference, but you see, the burr mill was not doing the fine work that this machine of mine was doing in regard to crushing it all the way down. So we had this set up. Well, then the next thing, I don't know why it was, but we shelled some corn. We got some corn meal, some regular table corn meal, about the granulation of table corn meal. And we put that in there because before I had that little experience of kind of a puffin business going on with that little tiny original thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we put this corn meal in there, and found out it was really too hot when you press it down. So I mixed a little bit of water in it, just a little water in it, so this would kind of cool things down, because I was still saying that this frictional heat idea was dangerous and it wouldn't work. You see, it was going to be in public use, or you couldn't have a thing setting on fire because of frictional heat. So I put this little water in there, and we put this cornmeal in there, and here come out some great long tubes, just keep shooting out 25 feet long before it broke. A tube would just run right out of the end of that motor.
4 inches in diameter.
And No, there's only six inches.
6 inches, something like that. I don't.
Six inches in diameter.
Six inches in diameter.
Oh my gosh, that must have been exciting. That must have been exciting when that came shooting out.
No,
like a stovepipe.
It wasn't six. It was about 4 inches in diameter.
That's why I think it was, you know,
about 4 inches in diameter. And the whole thing, you see, the whole throat and everything was probably about 8 or 10 inches long. The hopper part of it exposed of the screw, and the screw within the casing where it was compressing and everything. And so that's what happened there. Well, we began to get some ideas.
That was puffing, by the way, wasn't it?
It was puffing.
Just a hard surface. It was a puff surface pipe. You know, it was all puff.
Yeah. So that developed along about like that, and we sent some samples. You see, we kind of crushed it down by hand or something to make it look kind of flaky, you know, and so forth. And they sent samples around to the Phalen Candy Company, no, to the Quaker Oats, I guess it was. And we had some meetings in Chicago. Harry, he took care of all that executive stuff, meetings with them. And then we tried some soybeans.
Well, you made a confectionery this first. Filling the tube.
Well, that was done. You were getting ahead of yourself. That's done at Krause's. You got to wait till I get to Krause's for that. Then you see this. We did a little sort of, I think, Quaker Oats and something like that is about the only contact we had. And they got a little bit excited about it. And then we said the World's Fair was on, and we heard about Henry Ford having an exhibition down there and extracting oil. And that's the reason the soybean situation came up. So what we did, we made a sizable box of this flaked soybean, and we sent it down to the Chicago World's Fair for the Ford Company to examine it and see if there's anything about it that they thought that it would work. And it wasn't more, after that got down there, it wasn't more than about a day or two afterwards, and I was around the house there somewhere, and a car came tearing up in front of my house and slid their brakes. And one fellow jumped out of one side of the car and the other side of the car, and I said, "What goes on here?" I thought it was the sheriff out to arrest me or something, or something. And they said, "Are you Mr. Matthews?" And I says, "Yes." "Well, Mr. Matthews, before we go into any discourse at all," now this is about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, he says, "we want you to get on a train that will get you over to Detroit tomorrow morning. Just that quick. And we have a contact with the Ford Motor Company that they want to give it a real test of for some reason in regard to their plant there in this oil extraction seat." So that's what happened, and we went over there, and I was with Henry Ford 2 or 3 days. I sat around there and talked to him, chatted to him. He showed me his great big clock and watch accumulation there. He had a little, sort of a little room there. He had, I don't know, some 1,200 different alarm clocks and mantle clocks and grandpa clocks and all sorts of things there. Every sort of a, he it was his hobby, you know, to accumulate them as keepsakes and so forth.
Did you take your machine with you on the train?
No, I took the machine over
it was down.
I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah,
now.
I understood the machine got down to the World's Fair somehow.
No, I got it down there too quick. This thing over to the World's,
to Detroit?
Ford Motor Company, you see. What really happened was that the machine itself, before it got to the Chicago plant, I took in the back end of my Chevrolet car, between the front and back seats, and took it over
to
Detroit. And then how I'm getting, you see, my memory is getting pretty, but anyway, that's how it got over there, and then they gave it, that's where it got its first demonstration. And that's when he says, well, he called me in, Henry Ford called me in, he says, well, Mr. Mathers, we're very much interested with your machine there, and I want to have it sent to Chicago. Now we're going to get it down to Chicago from the Ford Motor Company.
Okay.
Dearborn. So he says, we're going to have it down there, and you get down there and be with it when, at the World's Fair, and we'll see what we can make out with it. Well, there were some other executives around there with him, you know, when they was talking to me about sending it down to the World's Fair. And they said, now, Henry, keep your mental balance here. He says, we don't know anything about this to go to something like this. It isn't so proven. He says, I am running this experiment. This is going to be put on a car, an express or whatever it is, and it's going to be put down to the World's Fair in Chicago. And Mr. Matthews is going to be down there to supervise doing what we can down there with the oil extraction temporary experimental setup we have there. So we put it, sent it down there, and it was down to the World's Fair, and they ran some experiments. But what really happened there? Something happened there that they didn't have a solvent that would work with this particular flake, and.
There was a barn in the back of the main manufacturing demonstration. They had a barn, you know.
This is side two of Claire Matthews and Homer and so forth. And we're in, Homer is saying that they had it in a barn out behind.
Well, that's my impression. What I was there.
At the World's Fair.
He had built a barn and had the grain exhibit was separate from the manufacturing. He had a manufacturing building.
Yeah, but this oil extraction was by itself.
In a barn.
It was kind of a shed. It wouldn't really be a shed down there, but
no,
it was a separate...
Like a farm barn, you know. I remember, and I was only 12 years old, but that was my impression. It was located in there.
Well, I've told the story for years that you told Ford that you had a machine as big as a card table to do the same work that the Alice Chalmers extractor as long as this room, and you put your machine in, and they roll the Alice Chalmers extractor out. Is that all imagination on my part?
Oh, there's the idea. That's where the big argument got in with his executives around him there, that he was going to throw whatever was out down there, and he said, we're going to put the Matthews machine in there, and that's going to be the coming thing in the place of the roller mill. That's what happened down in Chicago. And that's the reason they say, why, taking a thing just as fresh and unknown as this is, and take out a roller mill down there that you have established, he says, this is what we're doing. Don't forget, this is going on.
And so did he do that?
They did that.
Okay, now just a minute.
That's just...
Okay, Grandpa's saying he had the idea, but not the mechanical skill, and so he took in...
Was that Sweppy?
And, of course, Nielsen was the engineering outfit.
Well, where do I get the name Krusey? Or who? Krusey or Kruse?
Krause. That's here.
Krause.
Yeah, but there was a Krause of Lloyd. I thought it was Krause that you did.
Well, it was a Krause Milling Company. The two brothers that were had a farm grinding...
Yeah, yeah.
Mill.
Al was one of them.
Yeah.
And the other one I thought was the one that you split your idea with. But that wasn't true. It was Swepke. But I didn't realize that Swepke was tied into this thing.
Well, Swepke, you see, was right
machine
from the start. I went to him for the first mechanical help to make the first crudest mill, the number one.
Well, then I understood that you split your half with Harry Adams, we'll say.
And Barry.
And Barry got a half of Shreppy stock.
Well,
so that made
about
four
of you. Right straight. Swepke and I had the whole thing.
Yeah, okay.
We were partners together.
Okay.
Then you see we went up to Harry Adams, and he had called in Barry, and we settled the thing to make it really worthwhile and to encourage these fellows with finance and so forth and legal, taking care of legal aspects of everything, you see, we had to be pretty generous. So what we did was to give them, we each had 15% for ourselves, and that made 30, and the 70% was divided between Adams and Barry, something like that. So they had the big hold on things, but you know that those fellows, with anything that showed no proof of anything to go any stronger than that, you wouldn't get them encouraged to take part, see. So that's what we did, because we thought a smaller holding with somebody to really give it a boost in advertising and engineering that both of them could do, you know. That's what happened there.
Could I interject sure. something?
Go ahead.
Did you get through to the first machine, one of the first machines with the roller skate one?
Oh!
I mean, this was tremendous.
Yeah, in there somewhere I had a
way
roller skate.
Way before this now.
This is one of the original machines. I had some roller, I made a kind of a track around there that had bumps in it, and this roller went over these bumps.
Now this is roller skate.
Now what happened was, as this turned from the power in a circular motion, these roller skates made it bounce. See, and it kind of unchoked it and kind of made a kind of a pounding action along with the pressure action.
This is
you see
wagon
screws?
Wheel and skein now.
Yeah. Wagon wheel and skein. But where is the roller skates?
The roller skates are up on top of the shaft. The bearing which is the skein? The inside?
Skein is inside.
Yeah, it's
raised up and down with these rollers. So it's going around like this.
Yeah, you see the
shoe with the belt on the bottom, you know, pulley on the bottom, so that it's, you know, constantly going up and down like a wash machine plunger would.
Yeah, because there was a track there, in other words, had scallops in it. And as this went around, you see it went around like this, you see, and the whole thing kept a bouncing.
He's bouncing his arms up and down.
I am in a basement. My grandfather is holding the machine down because it wants to jump around like a live monster. My dad is trying to put in a small milk strainer, you know,
top of a
milk strainer. He's trying to pour grain in there, and his motor is trying to go 1600 RPM. And the thing is, just like a monster is going all over the basement with him trying to feed grain into it. I remember that. That was down in
the story.
Milwaukee Road.
The story has all of these incidentals in it, just whether they're spaced, just really spaced in the right rotation. I don't know, but that's.
That's one of the earlier models.
The really earlier models. Yeah, but of course all that was discarded when Barry got in there. He didn't want any roller skate toddlements and everything in the model that he made, because he made real.
Well, you got way away from that, Pa, before you even got to Adams. Though you were spinning.
Yeah.
You were
it wasn't workable. So
he finally got down to a little burr about that big.
Well, he was puffing with the skein and the wagon wheel and skein. He was puffing. In fact, you wanted to cut open the machine to see what the heck was causing it to puff. I remember you said, we got to get something in there, some iodine glass or something.
Oh,
I don't recall if you really
that brings an idea. This happened in Swepke's machine shop. We had it set up there, and this hot business was going on, you see, with even this model that Barry designed and everything. This heat business going on. He said, we got to cool down that machine some way, even though it was doing the puffing and doing things like that. He said, this is, there's no control, you see, of keeping the heat at a uniform temperature. So he says, we got to do something like this. So they got an old auto car radiator in there, and they made a jacket on the thing, you know, to keep this thing cool. Well, just as soon as they put this radiator cooling business on, it wouldn't do a thing. It just macerated in there and plugged. So he said, well, I guess maybe Claire's idea of the frictional heat was it. The frictional heat is the whole thing about that machine that made it work.
Your first flakes were made on your barn.
But you had to have it controllable.
That's what we got here in the book.
And you see, what made it controllable was granulation and moisture. And when I arrived at the Krauss Milling, now here's another thing. This went over to the Krauss Milling plant, and they had a contract taking the machine right out of the flake oil establishment over there and put it right under at Krauss Milling plant. With my being over there to do the development work in a little corner of the building there, and I've discovered that moisture was a definite thing and granulation was a definite thing. And it took me quite a while. You see, I was there about
gelatination.
About a year and 23 months or something doing all this before I got the thing to work. But what really happened, you had to have the moistures between 14 and 17%, or it wouldn't do this puffing business with the little pigtails coming out around the orifice of this disc and a rotor. You see, you had a rotor here and a disc turning, a screw working in there, and out at the end here was a stationary rotor. A rotor, and there was a stator, and this was squeezed out between this 6-inch surface there, with also grooves in that, and then these pigtails would start to come out. First of all, you had to warm up the machine with a little moist, I guess I used moist wheat or something, to get it warmed up some, and then you gradually feed in the cornmeal that had the moisture, and then it would just kind of stop a moment, and then all of a sudden these little pigtails would start coming out, and they'd just break off from gravity, see? They'd keep coming out of there, just a dangling and everything, and so far as my inventing that sort of thing, I didn't do that inventing at all. It just circumstances or whatever it is, combination of things made it do it.
Well, isn't that what inventing is sometimes? It just happens?
Yeah, and we sent, the first sample we made was 600 pounds of this stuff. I was able to make that go, to make 600 pounds, and sent it to Brock Candy Company, Chicago,
uh-huh.
The candy company. And they were all excited, and then we sent some to the Faline Candy Company. And then there was a fellow in Milwaukee here called Dorn, I think, Dorn Company, that he wanted it to caramelize it and put some peanuts in it and so forth. Well, while I was at Krauss's, he bought some 3 tons. I made 3 tons of that stuff for Dorn that was put around for sale, and things were really going, and the plant blew up. This plant blew up down here completely, and the only 2 parts of that Krauss Milling plant that wasn't blown to pieces was a little corner of where I was in. There was a wall and everything, and I was out at the end of the main part of the plant, and the wheat paste plant was across the tracks, the switch tracks on the other side. Oh. They were the only things that weren't blown all to smithereens.
A dust explosion.
And
people killed in the dust explosion?
Oh, yeah.
And you were saved. You were in this.
There was two men killed, I guess, and about 10 were seriously injured.
I'd heard a half a dozen of it, just my memory going back.
Well, there was quite a few. I was more than that, I think, Bob.
Well, then you see, their plant was all out of business, so that threw me out of business with my mill. Your friend
standstill.
So then Swebke, Swebke came. Oh, Swebke had a sailor and a soldier in there. They'd gotten in the organization, and they just fought. I never saw two fellows fight more than those fellows did. What is that one fellow's name?
Wilson.
Reeve. They didn't get along at all because one was a gob and wasn't a soldier.
Reed from Darien and Wilson from Bloyd, and yeah. Wilson was the sailor.
Yeah, and they fought all the time. There was no progress made there because they fought all the time.
Well, this has nothing to do with the barn.
Oh, yes, it does. It all began in the barn.
Well, I'm just talking about... I don't
She'll
know,
have
like,
to
I,
shoot
I,
a lot of that out, I think, mm-hmm. where she wants
well,
it.
Here's the way that I... you gave me a little stock because you stayed down in the house. And I don't know if I owned the house or...
Griffith
owned the
Griffith
house.
Owned the house. We rented from him.
Well, I furnished milk and the garden and so forth. And once in a while, I'd say once in a while, a couple of times, that they don't you think, Claire, you ought to give me a little piece of this thing for the milk and so forth.
And you see your
butter. Yeah, you paid for your interest that I gave you in milk and butter, and I even got some meat. That you slaughtered and everything. I've got quite a little food off on one deal I had with you folks.
Well, I got 3%.
Yeah.
And I never let go. I'll go through this very fast. I never let go of it.
Yeah.
And the stock got so... so widely divided that every time that there would be a director's meeting, they would throw the rascals out.
Thank you.
And a new bunch of rascals would become the board of directors.
Yeah.
And the old group that had been running the plant for 2 years would be denied even looking at the books, I guess. And the plant was making a little money there in Beloit, and it was just making enough money to allow the officers to have a minimum salary or a fair salary. There's nothing in dividends.
No.
And every 2 years I would hear from almost everybody that had stock wanting to buy my 3%, or mine and my father's, or however it was divided up. And I'd listen to them and have a lot of fun with it. But I always hung on to the stock. I hung on to the stock until they sold off to Beatrice. And...
Well, you see, there was a man in Chicago there. What was his name? You remember that old... an old man down there. There was a buttermilk man. Sold buttermilk by the carload. He got some interest down there because he would have contact with a lot of big business and everything else, you see, in his business, so he was taken in. And then some company down there, the Staley Starch got
Staley
in it.
Staley Starch, yes, I was going to mention
Staley that. Starch got in it because they were in the starch business, you see, and they could probably use some puff business to get their starch. And of course, Quaker Oats all the time was hanging fire in there because they'd back farther, they'd got some interest in
it. They wanted to crush their oat hulls so that they wouldn't blow all over the town when they tried to burn them. They wanted to get them into a concentrated form.
And in the meantime, right along in there, just when they invented and developed and put on the market the Cheerio, the little circles. Because I talked to the Quaker Oats people, he came there to see the machine run it in Swepke's plant there.
So the Cheerios were a takeoff from what you did?
No, they have no relation. Their system and method is absolutely original. Has nothing to do with it. The oats are hulled, and I don't know to this day how they make those little circles, because it's been done for many things, dog food and everything else now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it went over in a big way.
Well, Staley Starch, in using this and applying your material, your machine, was going to shorten the period for making beer by 2 or 3 days.
That could be. Then there was some fellows in Chicago. They were called the Fisher Buddy. I think it's Fisher Brothers that are in Chicago got an interest. And then finally the Elmer Brother Candy Company down at New Orleans got in on it. And various, as you spoke of, many different fellows got tied up.
Group in Ohio.
Yeah, there's a group in Ohio. Where was that place?
They came up to see me about my 3%.
Yeah. Well, in general, that's... Then, when I went back after the explosion, I went back to Beloit, but they couldn't pay me anything. See, Swepke, the way he was running it and everything, they hadn't got it going. They couldn't keep me alive. I had to do something. Well, in the meantime, you see, Krause's took me back because they knew some of my ingenuity in this milling business. They put me back and put me in, not too long, as in department, in charge of their special department. It was a department that had to do with making all sorts of flakes, foundry flakes for Ford and all those big people, and the movie people bought a whole lot of white flakes for snow and all those things. And then, you see, that got me away from flake oil for several years. And then when the explosion happened, you see, well, then I went back there temporarily, and as I said, I couldn't make a living, and they...
Francis took you back.
Yeah.
Foundry flakes. What are foundry flakes?
Well, foundry flakes are mixed with the sand to give it bulk and so forth in the molding of the iron.
Mm-hmm. So this wasn't a food type flake?
No.
It was used, actually,
the Ford Company and some great big gigantic companies used it for the foundry, mixed in with their foundry.
Well, there's a binder too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was sort of a binder and so forth. It had some of it, and then they had sausage. Oh, they sold a lot of flakes to sausage plants as a filler, see, so that it would take the place of meat, you know, and cheapen the meat element and make it bind together, the starch to make it bind together, and ammunition, all sorts of flakes for ammunition.
So that this was a method that made flakes, no matter, out of almost anything.
Yeah.
But that wasn't your machine.
That was done by roller mills, gigantic roller mills.
Krause's
was a gigantic. I was in charge of roller mills there.
Are they still operating?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
As far as I know, they're sure it's still operating down there.
Well, is this, how much more of this do you think we need, Dad, for...
Well, I think we pretty well covered flake oil.
I don't know. It's a little haphazard. My mixing up the timing, you see, of things. It's a little mixed up. You can iron it out.
Jack is interested in flake oil, but what she's particularly interested in is Grandpa Dogan's relationship to his hired men and life at the farm and... For instance, you were the guy that got Grandpa away from the bull, weren't you?
Yeah, when he was on
him. Okay. Tell me that story.
Oh, there was two. There's two things happened there. He had a hammer or a wrench, I forget what it was, and he was out in the barnyard, and he didn't know. I guess the bull was out there, but anyway, he got cornered up and. And the bull was after him. He got up on top of this high manure pile so that he'd have more protection. And I heard him calling, you know. I was around the barn there, and I went out there, and that bull was just tearing his horns in the manure pile there and getting closer and closer to your dad, and I went out with a pitchfork.
Grandpa was on top of the manure pile?
Yeah.
There in the barnyard where
I was in the barnyard with the bull, but I had a pitchfork, mind you. A good, strong pitchfork to fight away the bull from Mr. Dogan.
Uh-huh.
So I saved his life. Then the other...
Now, wait, give us a few more details. I mean, did you actually puncture the bull?
Oh, Mr. Dogan got out of there, you see, and then I opened up a certain door there, and with the pitchfork, the bull didn't want any of my pitchfork business, see.
Uh-huh.
So I kept urging him over and got him into that little stall and clapped the door on him. But there's one thing about Griffith was nearer death than that. He had a bullpen there, and it had a rack in it that you put hay from the outside of the building into this rack, and it had another door in which the bull would be taken in or taken out. So I was out there in the back of the barn outside there, and this was in a separate building, see. And I heard Mr. Griffith just yelling his head off in there. And I heard boards a breaking and everything else, and I went over there, and here he'd gotten in there, and the bull had got between him and the door, and the bull was just about ready to get him, and he crawled under this hay rack that had a space underneath it, see? He crawled in under there, but the bull was a-tearing this hay rack down piece by piece. And I came in with my pitchfork again, you see, and I held that bull a bay there away from Griffith till he got out of the building there, and then, of course, I could shut the door again, and we had the...
You don't mean hay rack, you mean hay, the manger.
It was a hatch slat.
Not a hay rack with wheels.
No, it was just a sort of a place for holding hay.
Under the
it had a kind of a trough you could push some meal
in. Listen,
so.
Tell that one about when Mr. Dogan was on the hay fork.
Oh,
wait,
yeah.
What sort of yelling on the manure pile? Just help, help, and so forth?
Just help. Yelling for help. Help. What? I don't remember what he said.
Uh-huh.
But then the other thing that happened to
me. Now, wait, hay fork coming up. Tell me, after you'd saved Grandpa's life, do you remember what he said? Did he say anything to you? He must have said something.
He might have. I couldn't remember now. I guess he was certainly gratified
was
to think that his life was... And then another time...
Okay, the hay fork.
They had something wrong with the hay fork plate up there. You see, the hay fork track came out there, and they drive the...
I know.
And you let the hay fork down. Well, something went wrong upon the track there.
With the trip.
So they let the fork down, and Daddy got on top of this hay fork. And then we took a horse on the hay fork rope, and we slowly dragged him up there so he could see what was going on. And he was sitting on this hay fork. And he bumped his head on something up there, and we saw him just go like that on top of that hay fork. And we didn't know what to do. We didn't know whether we dared let him down but fortunately, in 2 or 3 minutes, he came due, so he showed he had some life, and we let him down again, but he never did fix what was to be fixed up there.
I can
bang his head at the top, and that was it.
And you remember that one, too?
Well, I don't know if I was there. I was driving the horses but it's so familiar, because maybe he's been telling it to me, but... I'm so, been so personally related with
him. Oh,
okay, well, that's a story I've never heard.
Well, you know, if he'd tumbled, he was up there 10, 15 feet or more. If he'd fallen off in that hay fork there in between those wide spaces, you know, or whatever it is, we didn't know what to do.
He wouldn't have fallen into the hay?
No.
No, there was no hay there. It was just the bare floor.
This was a floor there.
See, we were just doing a repair job of getting him up there to repair that thing before we got the load in there or anything.
So was it where it turns, where it comes into the barn and then turns?
Yeah, and then went around.
Yeah,
went around
so
up there.
So that was the trip.
Distributed the hay around.
That trip is 30 feet above the barn.
Yeah, it's run, you know, right on the main approach, the apron, and going to the barn. Then it's, you put your
And we were
yeah, it was right. Well, then there was
we pulled
feet
the fork
there.
Down right inside the barn on the level floor, you see.
And Grandpa climbed on.
He climbed on that, and we took a horse. Because it's quite a thing to pull up a man on that fork, you know, and took a horse and led it carefully and kept watch of everything. Nothing wrong with what we were doing. Pulled him up there very, very slowly, and for some reason or other, there was... You didn't watch where his head was or something, he'd give his head a good crack, you know. And he just went like that, right on the rack. And we thought, my goodness, did
Grandpa
he kill himself or got a brain concussion or what's going on here? And finally, in a minute or two, he roused himself and he started to get a hold of things and got himself straightened up. And we let him down, but he never did any repair work.
That was his nature always, very energetic.
Always,
you know,
to do it.
Drive. Yeah, why, yeah.
Oh, he'd go out in the fields and run tractors, you know. Yeah. In my early day, I know when I first went out, he'd go out there and drive a tractor and plowing and things like that.
My recollection of him was, and I lived, worked with him for 20 years, that if there were three or four men standing around and the job could be done, he would be the first one to grab a shovel.
Let somebody
18 and 20 years old wait for his leadership.
I had a lot of affection for him.
He was energetic. I'm telling you, he worked hard. He was a hard-working man. You know?
Do you remember what he said when he came down off that rack?
I can't.
The hay rack?
I can't remember that, but I think he was glad to be alive.
He didn't usually say too much. I think because of his affliction.
When I first went out there, he gave a YMCA membership to every single man that worked for him.
I remember that.
Yeah. And then in those days, you know, we had all our single fellows had all our mules right at his stable.
Okay, now you lived in the house then for a while and took your meals
I lived in the house.
Tell me what it was like living in the house.
Well, I think there was four or five men. There were a couple that were married, but there was four or five of us that worked for the farm that were single. And we had, I think, two bedrooms up there that we used. And then we go down to the mules. And one of the things always in the morning, he always read the Bible and gave a prayer.
At the breakfast table?
Yeah, and then he would give a prayer for lunch and for supper. He'd always have a prayer and read the Bible in the morning.
The Bible was in the morning only.
Yeah.
And then the prayer at all the meals.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, you guys ate in the kitchen for breakfast, but you ate out at the dining room table for lunch and for dinner at noon and supper at night.
That could be, but you see, there was quite a few of us there. There would be maybe, I don't think their kitchen could be. I wonder if
that's a big kitchen.
Yeah, but you didn't have that big table until I was a little kid when they got the
big table.
Well, they got that from the post office, that big slab of
Well, it wouldn't be worthwhile for me to argue with that at all.
Well, maybe you ate breakfast out in the dining room too.
It seemed like all of our meals were out there.
The dining room was large too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then you were out in the dining room for breakfast too.
And sometimes after the meal was through with the meal, he would get into some discussion with the men about the work of the day, or any particular thing would come up in regard. Sometimes he'd talk to me about the cattle business. I was in charge of the herd, you know, and the cattle. He'd talk things over with me, or tell what he wanted certain men to do in certain fields. Then the horses did all the power work. In those days, there was no tractors, no nothing, but the good old horses did all the power work of the farm. I remember
one job I had was to groom those horses in the morning.
Yeah.
Other people did it too, I don't doubt, but it seemed to me I could look down this row of 7 to 9 horses and think what a job I got on my hand.
What, to curry them? And
by the way, did you know Jesse Hunt? Was he there by the way?
I think that's after my time.
Okay, let's go on to the big house. You'd come into that back room there. Did they have showers there, or a shower where you'd wash up?